Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Michael Riedel about his new book, Razzle Dazzle. We review The Bandstand at Paper Mill, Romance Language, Trip of Love, and we talk about Elizabeth Broadhurst in OK. Also, Matt Tamanini joins in to report on a television and film update. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 25th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantiere, Peter Felicia, and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and writes across other Broadway World sites, including Broadway World Orlando. He is the site's advertising database manager. Matt is a director, producer, playwright, and serves as executive and co-artistic director of the Squeaky Wheel Theater Project in Orlando. You can connect with Matt through Twitter at BWWMatt. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. How are you, James?
I'm good, thank you. With us today, we have a very special guest, a man who needs no introduction to our listeners. Michael Riedel is with us. Michael is the...
Good to be with you guys.
and in fact, I went back and looked at our notes. Michael, this is a return engagement to the
yes.
to the broadcast. Michael's been with us before on This Week in Broadway. A few years back, we'll put a link in the notes to if people want to go back and listen to that. But Michael, aside from his duties penning a column at the New York Post, has had enough time to get out and write a book, a very thick book called Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, which is on the...
It may be long, but it reads as quickly as a trashy Jackie Collins novel.
You know, I
let me be the judge of that.
Okay. Well,
you know, Riedel, how come?
If only it sells as many books as Jackie Collins' book.
How did you talk somebody at Simon & Schuster into producing a Broadway book?
Well, I'll be honest with you. When the proposal went around, we had a number of feelers from the major publishing houses, but the concern was that Broadway books fall into the Broadway ghetto, alas.
Yeah.
And you see most Broadway books are published by smaller publishers like, you know, Applause Books or academic presses. But Simon & Schuster and two or three other of the major publishers did respond to the aspect of the book that links the fortunes of Broadway to the fortunes of New York City. And that in the 70s, when New York was going bankrupt, Times Square was dangerous, and Broadway was in a very perilous position as well, the theater stayed alive, and there were a handful of people who stuck by Broadway and turned it around. And I try to make the point in the book that in saving Broadway, they also helped lift the fortunes of New York City. And the publishers, Simon & Schuster in particular, because they published the book, thought that was a bigger picture to paint, and that to weave in the history of New York's ups and downs and New York's revival with the revival of Broadway, but told through the stories of these very colorful people who stuck by Broadway and saved it, they thought that book had a little more appeal than a book that is, you know, just a critical survey, let's say, of the musicals of Stephen Sondheim. So, you know, they may have been fooled, but they bought it.
Michael,
It really is an excellent history book that I really do believe will become a textbook in many college courses. And for those who've said, you know, oh, he's a gossip columnist, I think you've shown that you're substantially more than that.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate that. I knew when I set out to write a book that there was no way I could write in the style of my columns. And the newspaper column, especially a gossipy theater column, has got to be snide and sarcastic and bitchy and on the attack and, you know, written with a little zing and pep and flair in the Walter Winchell tradition. But my God, if I'd written, this is a 432-page book. If I'd written a 432-page book in that style, it would be tedious on the fourth page. So I really deliberately set out not to write in the style of a tabloid newspaper man. And as I began to interview all the people for the book, as I interviewed some of the great old Broadway producers who told me their stories, I realized they told these anecdotes and these stories, and they reflected in a very theatrical, compelling way. And I had to get out of the way and let them do the talking.
Mm-hmm. I've only thus far read the excerpt that was in Vanity Fair, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Vanity Fair. Uh-huh.
Which that part of it is more specifically concerned with the competition between Nine and Dreamgirls for Best Musical, which absolutely fascinating in itself.
Yeah, it was an epic battle in 1982 for the Tony Award between Michael Bennett's Dreamgirls and Tommy Tune's Nine. And I used that set piece, if you will, because I knew about that story, and I cover a lot of rivalries at the Tony Awards, but this one was very interesting to me, and it worked the scheme of what I was trying to do with the book, because behind that battle is the battle to build the Marriott Marquis, you know, the very first thing that began to revitalize Times Square. But in order to build that hotel, which, you know, remains one of the ugliest pieces of architecture in the city, but in order to build that hotel, the city had to tear down the Helen Hayes and the Morosco Theater, two of Broadway's legendary theaters, as well as a little tiny theater called the Bijou. And the tearing down of those theaters caused a civil war within the Broadway community, because most of the actors, Joe Papp and the great playwrights, they were all on the side of the theaters. They didn't want 100 years of theatrical history to be wiped out. But the Schubert Organization, in particular, Bernie Jacobs and Jerry Schoenfeld, who ran it then, and who are two big, powerful people, players in my book, they were big proponents of revitalizing Times Square, and they put the weight of the Schubert Organization behind the tearing down of those theaters and the building of the Marriott Marquis. And a lot of people on Broadway blamed them for the loss of those theaters. And it was all this battle for the safe theaters was going on, so too was this battle between Dreamgirls, produced back by the Schubert Organization, and Nine, which was kind of backed by a lot of flying by the seat of their pants young people. Young producer named Francine Lefrak, and Jimmy Niederlander was in there, and Sam Cohn, the agent, was there. And when people went to vote, I do believe, they thought, you know what, we are so pissed off at Bernie and Jerry for wanting to build this horrible hotel. We're going to vote against Dreamgirls, and we're going to vote for Nine. And so that backstage gossipy stuff also tied in with the story I was trying to tell about how Times Square was revitalized. So that would give you an example of a gossipy bit, but that also served its place for a larger point I was trying to get at.
Okay, but the question becomes, Jerry made the statement in the book, you quote him as saying, look, these are not musical theaters. These are playhouses. And as a result, they're not going to get the type of bookings that are going to happen in the future, because we're becoming a much more musical-centric Broadway. Do you agree with that?
Little did he know that nowadays lots of playhouses, quote unquote, are used as musical houses, but I guess he had no way of knowing that.
Yeah, I know he would have had no way of knowing that. I mean, Jerry was, to his credit, really one of the very, very first people to push, and he pushed aggressively to revitalize Times Square. I mean, we give a lot of credit to Rudy Giuliani and Disney, but they come much later. Jerry was fighting for this in the 70s. I mean, Jerry, you know, formed the Midtown Citizens Committee, which was the very first civic, public and private group of people who really thought we've got to save Times Square. Now, for Jerry, it was obvious. his business was there. If Times Square was going to go down the tubes, so was the Schubert Organization. So he was doing it really to survive. I'm ambivalent about the whole theater situation. I love the great old theaters. I think a place, you know, the Marasco where Death of a Salesman premiered should still be with us. And as much and as ugly as I think the Marriott Marquis is, I cannot deny that it really did begin the revitalization of Times Square, because nothing, there was nothing in Times Square back then that would attract people who weren't really on the lookout for shady kinds of things. And here you're going to put this hotel, which, by the way, if you look at it closely, it was designed like a bunker. All right. The lobby is on the eighth floor above the riffraff. It was designed to make people come to New York and feel safe, feel right. protected from their, from what was going on around them in Times Square. But it was a reasonably priced hotel for middle and upper middle class people to venture into New York and not feel terrified at night because they felt safe in the hotel. And Bernie and Jerry knew if you had people coming to that hotel who were looking to go to legitimate, shall we say, things, that is Broadway shows, they were right there in the neighborhood. And that hotel could feed people into the Broadway theaters. And indeed, that is, I think, over time what happened. But, I mean, you look at pictures of the Helen Hayes and the Marasco. They were wonderful theaters, and there's no question that we lost, you know, 100 years of Broadway history when those theaters came down. But that
and they weren't Schubert theaters either.
Well, that's, I don't think Bernie and Jerry would have torn down their own theaters. That's
odd how that works.
Exactly. I'll never forget.
They were willing to sacrifice a couple of theaters that they didn't. Although that must be said, the Schubert brothers did build those theaters back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, tell us about the impetus behind this book that you've written. Well, you know, how did you decide to pick just the bookends of these years to tell this story?
Well, what I really wanted to get at, as I say, was I wanted to show how the importance of Broadway to the saving, the revitalization of New York City. Because for years, you know, I've lived here, as you have, through Times Square in its seedy days, and what it is today, this glimmering, shining tourist attraction that is, you know, generates a massive income for the city, and Broadway, too. But I was interested in the struggle of how Broadway really was saved back then. And I also wanted to get across the point, because I often hear when people talk about we need to revitalize cities, they talk about sports franchises. You know, we need a sports team, we need to build a new stadium. And I've always believed that the arts are fundamental to a vital city. And that when Broadway, when New York was down for the count and Times Square was really seedy, New York has one thing that no other city in the world has, and that's Broadway. And people who worked on Broadway, who loved Broadway, whose lives were tied up to Broadway, they didn't give up on the theater district. They stuck by it, and they worked like hell, and they really had a lot of battles they had to fight to turn it around and save it. And I just think that Broadway never really got the proper credit, and the Broadway theater artists never got the credit for doing their part to revitalize Times Square and New York City.
Two stories from me. In 1970, I guess it would have been, I went with a friend to see Butterflies Are Free, and we were not, I wouldn't exactly say mugged, but we were strong-armed on the street in the middle of the day in Times Square by two disreputable gentlemen into like giving them money. And then a few years later, I guess the early 80s, I was working in 1515 Broadway, believe it or not. And I went out on my lunch hour one day and somebody came up to me and pretended to have, or maybe really did, have a gun in his pocket and tried to get me to. So this is what the reality was back then. And people don't quite realize it.
Well, but, as Michael writes, I'd rather a thriving, if touristy, Times Square than a sad, derelict one, and I agree with that.
Well, absolutely, but I'm so curious. It does seem like there's been a bit of a weird backturn lately with all of the negative publicity on Times Square in terms of the painted ladies and the really aggressive characters and costumes, and also people trying to push CDs.
Yeah, he used to be Tickle Me Elmo, now he's Steal Me Up Elmo. I got to tell you something, and I have to give Jerry Schoenfeld credit. When they when Jerry saw the plans for the Marriott Marquis Hotel in the 70s, the plans included a pedestrian plaza. And Jerry was absolutely against that because he thought the pedestrian plaza would just be a place for shady, nefarious people to gather and harass his customers. And indeed, that does seem to be what's happening now. And I really think Bill Bratton, our police commissioner, and Mayor de Blasio, they have to keep an eye on that because things can slide very quickly. And once people begin to fear being somewhere, they start staying away, and that becomes a problem.
Yes, and Patti LuPone went on record as saying how much she hates being in that area. I know many friends of mine say they avoid it like the plague, as I do. We even saw an example of, I can't remember now, maybe one of the other guys does, of a theater, an off-Broadway theater that advertised as a plus the fact that it's not in Times Square.
Several of the city officials I interviewed for this book who talked about Jerry's efforts to save Times Square told me if Jerry had lived, there would be no pedestrian plaza in Times Square. The Schubert Organization would have fought that tooth and nail, and they had a lot of influence with the city. When they were thinking of putting that pedestrian plaza there in the late 70s, not only did Jerry oppose it, but so did the great old producer Alex Cohn, who called it, who said it's going to be Needle Park. He thought it would be a place for vagrants to do drugs and whatnot. So turns out those guys may have been right.
A few months ago, Joe Domenowitz at the Daily News had an article that was talking about maybe creating a park zone in there. Because if you create a park, you can't have any of the characters in there because you can't operate a business within the park.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, there, you know, before this plaza, there have been lots of other places in throughout the city where you would think that this might have become an issue, like South Street Seaport and,
I think the theater owners really don't like it, and producers certainly don't like it because it's just a nightmare for people to get around it. For people to get their cars in and all that kind of stuff to come to see their shows. And a number of people have told me that really since the death of Jerry Schoenfeld in 2008, there has not been somebody who's really been effective, who represents the Broadway community in dealing with the city. That was really something that Jerry did brilliantly. And no one has filled that void, the relations between Broadway and the city, and that's one reason why things are kind of tangled up now. But that goes to show you just how powerful Jerry was back in those days. And Jerry dealt with the city. Bernie Jacobs, his business partner who ran the company with him, Bernie's great strength was in producing the shows. Bernie's great strength was in his relationships with people like Michael Bennett, who created the chorus line Dreamgirls, of course, and with Cameron McIntosh and Andrew Lloyd Webber. You know, Cameron McIntosh told me when he was a kid producer with no money, and he produced little shows in London. And he had some sort of a cheap airline ticket to come to New York for the very first time. And he was talking to a couple of guys who own theaters in London, and they said, "You got to meet our friend Bernie Jacobs while you're in New York." And I remember this is Cameron McIntosh before he was Cameron McIntosh. And Cameron presented himself, and you know Bernie took him to lunch and asked him where he was staying. And Cameron, you know, was in a cheap hotel, and Bernie said, you know, Betty and I have a house, use our guest room. And for years, when Cameron McIntosh was just a kid and he would come to New York and he had no money, he always stayed in Bernie and Betty Jacobs' guest room. He used to call it my New York crash pad. And it was because Bernie liked him, and all Bernie saw in him was a talented, passionate, eager kid who might someday do something. Well, it turned out that talented, passionate, eager kid did Cats, Les Miserables, Phantom, and Miss Saigon, and made the Schuberts hundreds of millions of dollars. But Bernie was very good at spotting young people who just were completely committed to the theater business and developing relationships with them.
So who is the new Bernie Jacobs then? Are we looking for the various folks at the large multinationals that are producing Broadway to undertake these roles?
I don't think you'll ever have two guys like Bernie and Jerry who really dominated the business, because now corporations are never going to be dominated by the real estate guys. And the producers are so powerful in their own right because they made so much money with shows like Wicked and Jersey Boys and Mamma Mia, that they're not going to be pushed around by the Schuberts. I mean, you have to remember, Bernie and Jerry, they ran everything back in the day. They negotiated all the union contracts. They ran the League of American Theaters and Producers, the Broadway League as it is today. They ran the Wing. They ran the Actors Fund. They controlled the real estate. They controlled Michael Bennett. They had their deals with Cameron and Andrew for all those great shows. They dominated the business. I mean, not for nothing, it was Bernie Jacobs called the Godfather. And I remember the very first time I ever saw him would have been, I think, 1991 or 1992 at a United Jewish Appeal benefit in which he was being honored. And I was working in Theater Week back then, Peter, so I was like 22 or something. And I remember going to the event and, you know, I'd heard of this Bernie Jacobs. I knew he was powerful around the Schubert Organization. And I looked at the table where he was sitting with his family, and there was a line of people waiting to pay their respects. And it looked exactly like the wedding from The Godfather. That's what it was. I don't think anyone is ever going to have that kind of power in the theater. Now, the power is all diffused, spread around now. But, you know, Bernie and Jerry were running a business, certainly back in the early 70s, that was not a multi-billion dollar global business that it is today. It was a real backwater of the entertainment world. In fact, I begin my book, the first chapter is about a ticket scalping scandal in the early 60s. And I wanted to start the book that way because I wanted to show people that this business, once upon a time, had been a real seedy, mucky kind of place to work.
In the, let's see, when would it have been? In the 80s, I had a friend who worked in a box office, and I brought up the question of ICE one day, and he clammed up like, I can't even tell you. Yeah. I mean, his face turned like white.
Wow.
And white as ice.
Mike,
we should probably explain what ICE is.
Yeah.
This is a very simple example of it, but it completely seeped through the entire industry back at the time when I began the book. If a ticket, let's say the face value of a ticket in 1960 was $10, say for the sake of argument. If you're the box office treasurer at My Fair Lady, and there are only 1,500 seats a night, the hottest show in the world, a lot more people, just 1,500, want to see that show on any given night. So if you have access to that $10 ticket, you can just take that ticket off the shelf, put it in your pocket, go to a ticket broker or a ticket scalper, and sell him that ticket. And let's say he gives you $50 for that $10 ticket. Well, that's $40 cash that you put in your pocket and is never traced, and it was called ICE because it melts away. And the ticket broker would then take the $50 ticket now and sell it to his customers for $100. Now, this was going on all the time, everywhere. Tax-free, IRS never knew anything about that, which is why it was illegal. And when I begin my book and the Attorney General discovers it, holds very public investigations that were on the front page of the New York Times back in those days, they estimated that year in and year out, the amount of ICE on Broadway was anywhere from $75 to $100 million in 1960. In today's dollars, that's $500, $600, $700 million all flowing around that the IRS never knew anything about. And it meant that Mr. GQ Public couldn't get a ticket to the hot show because they were all being funneled to the brokers. And everybody was doing it, including, as I say in the book, the Schubert Organization. In fact, they had a room 504 in the Sardi Building, where they were selling the tickets to the brokers and dividing up the money and distributing up and down the chain of the Schubert Organization, right up to the top, right up to Larry Schubert Lawrence, the drunk nephew of JJ, who was running the company back then.
So, Michael,
and Bernie and Jerry being lawyers, remember, they've been JJ's lawyers. Bernie and Jerry's were lawyers, and they knew that this was totally illegal, and the company, if there were an investigation, the whole company could be shut down. And indeed, when I was researching it, because I had to look closely, you know, were Bernie and Jerry involved in this? Their characters, I had to know. Mm-hmm. And I tracked down he's 87 now. He was the assistant attorney general who investigated the ICE scandal back then. And I asked him point blank, I said, I need to know, were Bernie and Jerry into it? And his quote, which I have in the book, was, I'm not here to excuse anyone or whitewash anyone, but I will only say that in the course of my investigation, two people were very helpful, and they were Bernie Jacobs and Jerry Schoenfeld, because they understood what was at stake.
One of the things that was really had a huge impact on me in reading the book is that the enormous and powerful Shubert organization was on the ropes at times, and that, and that we seriously, if it weren't for those two gentlemen, we could have a different Broadway landscape today.
Well, you have to remember the J.J. Schubert, the last of the Schubert brothers, he died in the early 60s, and Bernie and Jerry had worked for him for many years as his lawyer, and it was not the happiest of circumstances because he was a total tyrant. But somebody needed to take over the company, and it had always been a family business. But J.J.'s son, John, died a few years before him, and he was the only heir, so there's nobody around. And indeed, Bernie had suggested that Jerry step forward and become the chairman back then, but Jerry was a little timid, and he felt it would look bad because it was a family business. So Lawrence Schubert Lawrence, J.J.'s nephew, was made the head, but he was a total drunk. I mean, he literally ran the company from the second floor bar at Sardi's, so he was never too far from a scotch. And he didn't care about the theater. He didn't care. All he cared about was just collecting the rent from the show. Schubert stopped producing. He rarely went to rehearsals. He rarely went to backers auditions. And when he would go, he was embarrassment because he'd be so drunk he'd hit on the chorus girls or something like that. And Bernie and Jerry suffered under him for 10 years until they finally realized the whole thing was falling apart. I mean, the Schubert organization was in dire straits. And they staged a boardroom coup, and they got him out, and they took control of the company for themselves. And I have an interview that Bernie Jacobs did with for his family before he died that his widow Betty let me use for the book. And he said when he and Bernie got control of things, the Schubert organization had a cash flow problem. They needed $1 million line of credit from J.P. Morgan to pay some bills. So Bernie went to J.P. Morgan, and he used as collateral the 17 Schubert theaters to get $1 million line of credit, and J.P. Morgan turned him down. They deemed in 1972 that 17 Broadway theaters were not worth $1 million. Mm. They were specialty use properties in a seedy neighborhood, and they were not worth $1 million. Now, jump ahead today, the Schuberts are going to build a 1,500-seat musical theater house on land they own on 45th Street and 46th Street. The minimum cost just to build the theater is $175 million for one theater. Now, they own the land. So if you had to buy the land and then build the theater, you're looking at $400, $500 million for one theater. But in 1972, according to J.P. Morgan, 17 Broadway theaters were not worth $1 million. That gives you, I think, in a nutshell, the state of Broadway back then.
Mm. Michael, I have a specific question. Do you know the Little Schubert? Do the Schuberts own that building?
Yes, they do. They built it. Yeah, they did.
All right,
they
built
it. It was a mistake, but they built it, yeah.
Right. And so now they are leasing the theater to others as of very recently and changed the name of it? Is that what happened?
I'm not sure of the details, the ins and outs. I mean, they built it when there was a brief period. Peter and Michael, you may remember this. Remember there was that period where Off-Broadway suddenly seemed to be the new thing, and Neil Simon was going off-Broadway, and Edward Albee was going off-Broadway, and Broadway was just, you know, it was just dying, or was just going to be for boring musicals, and all the real stuff was happening off-Broadway. They built that to capitalize on it. But then what happened was the business model changed, and as Michael pointed out earlier, producers figured out a way to get musicals into non-musical theater houses on Broadway, playhouses. They figured out how to work that. And then the play came roaring back because they thought, you know what, if we get Nicole Kidman or Hugh Jackman or Kevin Spacey in a play for 14, 15 weeks, the demand will be so great we can charge an arm and a leg for the tickets. So that's right. Why plays came back to Broadway. And then off-Broadway, really, the commercial off-Broadway was devastated, and they couldn't book the Little Schubert for years or whatever bookies they had didn't last.
Right.
So,
Michael, two lines.
Nothing ever stays the same in this business. That's why it's fun to cover. You know, it's constantly shifting.
Okay, two lines jumped out at me from the book. One, Stanley Kaufman, who, by the way, was a New York theater critic, Times theater critic for a year, Stanley Kaufman was uncomfortable being a public target, which inevitably comes with such an influential job. And there's also a quote, David Merrick didn't give a damn of what people thought of him. All right, Michael, correct. Where are you in that? Are you uncomfortable or comfortable with being a public target in such an influential job? And do you indeed give a damn what people think of you?
Well, I think my influence is greatly exaggerated, but I'm happy that people feel that way because this business is all smoke and mirrors. I really don't care what people think about me, and I don't care what they say about me. Listen, I've been dishing it out for years. I've certainly, taken a few swings at a number of theater people and their shows. So if they want to swing back, I think that's only fair, and it doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I like the give and take and the battling and the feuds. I think that's all part of the fun of covering Broadway. And what people think of me, I'm pretty confident in myself, and I have a thick skin, and I sort of go my own way in the world, and people can like me or hate me or say what they want to about me. I mean, it's interesting having a book out now because, people are reviewing it. So I now know what it's like to be reviewed, which is an interesting perspective in life. But I would never... I would never hold it against anyone who was upset at me for something because I can be a little devilish, shall we say. And you can't write a column, the kind of column that I do, or a book that I wrote, and you can't have your mind sort of going back and forth, well, are people going to be upset if I say this? Are people not going to like me because I say this? You just got to write it and make it fun and interesting and lively. And often in our business, fun, interesting, lively means gossip that is not terribly flattering to the subject.
It's funny to me how you use the phrase "take a swing at" because didn't you have at least one literal one of those?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't take.
You're the recipient of the swing.
Recipient.
I was the recipient of a swing from yes. From David Laveau, who was upset at the way I covered his Presbyterian revival of Fiddler on the Roof. And it wasn't a swing, actually. It was a shove. He shoved me off my bar stool. But you know what? We since made up after that. It's funny. All the feuds I've had, I wind up becoming friends with these people.
Any idea why?
Because I think I don't take it too seriously, and I make a joke about it all. And then when they meet me, I just kind of am the first to laugh at myself, which probably, I guess, is disarming to them. I was very surprised. There was a book party the last week when the book came out, and... I looked around and all the heavy hitters from the theater world were there. I mean, it was like a big, big opening night or something. And I looked around, I thought, this is a room full of people pretending to like me. Very interesting.
I wanted to get back to the Schuberts for just a second, just to clarify something, because you're talking about the enormous amount of money that the Schuberts are worth these days. And I wanted to point out the Schubert organization, which runs and produces the theaters and things like that, is actually owned by the Schubert Foundation. And the foundation, that money makes its way through the theaters to the foundation. And the foundation is responsible for putting out grants every year of millions and millions of dollars. I was just going to say that the money makes it back into support for nonprofit and professional theater and dance companies all around the United States. Just to let, because a lot of our listeners don't think that, they just pocket this money and go out and, they might do it at other organizations, but specifically the Schuberts, a lot of money makes it back.
It's an arrangement that is unique in the history of nonprofit and charitable foundations. And I'll try to not get too technical on it, but the history of it's interesting. Yes, you are right. The Schubert Organization, which is a multi-million-dollar for-profit company, is not owned by any human beings. It is entirely owned by the Schubert Foundation, which is a nonprofit entity that doles out grants to arts organizations around the company. Now, the foundation was set up by Lee and J.J. Schubert, two original Schubert brothers, in honor of their brother Sam Schubert, who really founded the company, but who was killed very young in a train accident. And they set up this foundation in memory of Sam Schubert, right? This is back in the 1910s, 20s. Over time, that foundation as it did for many corporations back in those days that had nonprofit arms. That foundation became a very convenient place to hide money from the IRS. Because remember, the IRS was not patrolling things the way they do back then. And the foundation just became a place to dump a lot of cash that never went to the U.S. government. And in the 70s, in the 60s, the IRS began to realize that such places as the Ford Foundation were completely connected to the for-profit Ford Motor Company. The Johnson & Johnson Foundation, completely connected to the Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Empire. And what the IRS realized was that these corporations were funneling a lot of money and hiding it in these foundations. And the IRS, the federal government, passed a law that forced every foundation and for-profit company to part ways. Today, the Ford Foundation has absolutely nothing to do with the Ford Motor Company. The Johnson & Johnson Foundation has nothing to do with the Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Company. But the Schubert Foundation still owns the for-profit. The Schubert Foundation still owns the for-profit Schubert Organization. And why is this? Because they were flying under the radar. They were kind of a small company. The IRS wasn't paying attention. And in the 70s, Bernie and Jerry, being lawyers, realized they had a problem. If the government finds out what's going on, they can break up this company. And Bernie and Jerry petitioned the IRS, saying, they made the argument that the theater business was perilous, had lots of ups and downs, and that theaters, which were not landmark back then, were easily torn down and made into parking lots. And that the foundation's purpose was to maintain the Schubert theaters, and only the foundation could do that. And if you separated the foundation from the theaters, those theaters very likely could be sold off and torn down. And they could only be held together as theaters by this nonprofit foundation. And the IRS said yes. To this day, the Schubert Foundation is the only nonprofit company in America that controls a multi-million-dollar for-profit company.
And I was just going to say, I have no idea if this is true, but it certainly sounds like it could be. Someone quoted one of the major Schubert higher-ups as having said, there's no profit like nonprofit.
that was something that, Jerry Schoenfeld used to say that, there's no profit like nonprofit. And, you know, listen, I'll tell you this, though, about Bernie and Jerry. They were very successful, and they were highly paid by the foundation. And they live very comfortable lives with limousines and flights on the Concorde and Barclay hotel suites and whatnot. But as they always said, and as Jerry always reminded me, he always said, Michael, as he used to speak, I am an employee of Schubert. I serve at the pleasure of the board of the foundation. They never had any equity in the company. They never got rich the way Jimmy Niederlander did, because Jimmy owns his own theaters and owns all his real estate. They never got rich like Cameron and Andrew, because Cameron and Andrew owned their shows. Bernie and Jerry never owned a piece of a hit musical, even though the Schuberts produced Dreamgirls and Cats and Phantom and all these big shows. They never owned any of the real estate. Yeah. They never owned any of the theaters. They were, as they always said, employees. And to this day, nobody can ever own the Schubert. Can ever own a Schubert theater. If you work for the Schubert organization, you serve at the pleasure of the board of the Schubert Foundation.
Speaking of Jimmy, do you ever think we'll get the Hellinger back?
I don't think so, because the way the contract is set up, Jimmy gave the Hellinger or rented it in the beginning to the church, Times Square Church, when he was in financial trouble in the 80s. And then eventually the church bought the theater.
Right.
Jimmy does have the first right to make a bid on it should the church ever sell it. But it's such a thriving church, such a thriving place for the Times Square Church, that the only way I've heard they would consider selling it is if a buyer were to find them a bigger and even better spot in Times Square. And that's very, very hard to do given the cost of buying anything in Times Square these days.
So I have three words for you.
Yeah.
Toys R Us.
It would change it to Prayers R Us.
What's going to happen at that big Toys R Us spot? Have you heard any rumors?
I have not. To be honest with you, I have not. I do not. What's going? I don't know what's going on there. Believe me, some big corporation will come in. I mean, it's too good to pass up in the display windows not to be selling some wares.
News Corp's new New York Times, New York Post headquarters there.
Nah.
I don't know about that. It is a shame that we lost the Hellinger back in the 80s. But, you know, as Jimmy said, and he really was in some financial trouble back then. Mm. And he was quoted as saying, how could you lease this out to the church? And he said, I'm in the theater owning business. I take the next booking. It happened to be a church.
I'm just not sure why they hindsight is 20/20, but why they went from the lease to the actual outright sale. I guess maybe the church said, we will only stay if you sell it to us.
They had a contract with Jimmy that allowed them to buy it at some point.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Michael,
you've got to remember, I mean, again, we know Jimmy's empire. You can't even put a price tag on his empire today with the theaters and the land he owns around the country. But I remember talking to a couple of his employees after Jimmy took some hits in the 80s, certainly with a big flop called Legs Diamond, and Jimmy was up to it. He had the lease on the New Amsterdam Theater, which was a decrepit theater back then, and his deal with the city was take the lease and refurbish it, but it cost a huge amount of money to refurbish it. He didn't have the money for that. He had no tenants at the New Amsterdam Theater. He tried to get Hal Prince to put Phantom there. He thought, if I can get Hal, my old friend Hal, to put Phantom there, I can raise money to fix up the theater. And Hal sent Jimmy a letter after he went to inspect the theater, a letter which I have and used in the book. Hal said, I got out of my cab and I was accosted on the street in front of the theater. He said, sorry, Jimmy, there's no way I would ever walk on that block, let alone put any one of my shows in that block. Now, today, the New Amsterdam, as we know, is the flagship for the Walt Disney Company and has Aladdin there. So you see, again, how things change.
Michael,
but just going back to Jimmy for a second, why he unloaded the Hellinger when he was really in financial trouble. I talked to some of his employees at the time, and they said, you know, we were all very loyal to Jimmy, and we loved him. But the word was going around the office, if you get another job, take it, because we're not sure Jimmy's going to survive.
Wow. Mm. Wow. Could you imagine? I can't imagine.
Michael,
as I was reading your book, I kept on getting the feel of Tom Wolfe's novel Bonfire of the Vanities. And Bonfire of the Vanities was a slice of life, reflective upon the 80s in New York City. And Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, I felt was a reflection of New York City in the late 60s, early and 70s. Do you think that this could be fodder for some sort of treatment for, you know, perhaps a movie, documentary, even a play?
I'm certainly flattered to be compared to Tom Wolfe. Although I must tell you, my models, like every writer I steal from other people. I didn't have Tom Wolfe in mind, but I had Robert Caro and David Halberstam and Gay Talese in mind when I was writing this book. Because what I admire about them, if you look at Robert Caro's The Power Broker, which is, you know, one of the great histories of New York City, centered on Robert Moses, a powerful public official who, you know, built highways and parks and did all this kind of stuff. He made Caro, even though it's a history book, he makes all the characters come to life. You know, it reads like a great, rich, juicy novel. If you read David Halberstam's The Powers That Be about all the great media empires, he makes all of the Henry Luce who created Time, the guy who created CBS. I've forgotten his name now.
Les Moonves?
No, Haley.
Haley.
Yeah.
He makes all of these characters. He makes them into rich characters. And as I sat down to write my book, I thought, all right, I'm telling you history here, but I don't want it to be an academic book. And I was blessed by having a theatrical cast of characters. You know, Bernie and Jerry were funny. They were powerful. They, you know, in some ways what my book is about how you acquire power, how you use power, and what power does to you. And so I show how they acquired the power, how they used the power, and ultimately how the power affected them. And believe me, when they were at the top of the game, they did not like to be crossed. If you didn't do what they told you to do, there were consequences for that. But I was blessed with this rich cast of theatrical characters, you know, Michael Bennett and David Merrick and Joe Papp and, you know, old producers we know like Manny Eisenberg, Liz McCann, and Tommy Toon and Andrew and Cameron. You know, they're theatrical characters, so they're inherently dramatic and compelling figures. And they're in a business where, you know, one season you have the biggest hit of all time, and the next season you have the biggest fiasco of all time. So that's really, I was trying to tell history, but through a colorful cast of characters that I think Caro and Halberstam do well. Now,
your recounting of the Tony night in which Dreamgirls was up against Nine is absolutely thrilling. It really is. And the end of it, especially the end of it was so amazing, where I won't give the whole thing away, but where a recount is demanded.
Jerry Schoenfeld, he was furious, and he wanted the ballots recounted. You know? And he was told, and I got this from the guy who ran the league, he said, Jerry, we burned the ballots precisely so we don't have this problem. And then Jerry said, well, sift through the ashes. the Schuberts had been defied. Dreamgirls was supposed to win the Tony, not Nine, for heaven's sakes, and somebody must pay for that. That was their attitude. But that's
yet Dreamgirls ran twice as long. So really, what's the problem?
Yeah. You know, Peter, as well as I do, everybody wants a Tony Award. But as far as dramatic rights go, listen, I'd be delighted if it were a miniseries. I have a very good agent, and I can't announce anything yet because there's nothing to announce. But yeah, I think they're shopping it around to see if there's something there. I don't know. I mean, I didn't write the book thinking it would be a movie or a miniseries or anything like that. I just wrote it because I knew these guys and I knew their stories and I knew their struggles. And I thought, if nobody writes this, I mean, if I don't write this, no one's going to do it, because I don't think anyone else could have put it together the way I did, if only because I was there at the right time. You know, I knew Jerry really well. I heard his stories. I'm very close to Phil Smith, who ran the company, who was a great source of the book. Mm-hmm. I've known a lot of the old-time producers who told me what it was like back in those days. I just think if I hadn't written it, this whole period of Broadway history would just have kind of disappeared, and we'd all sort of say, you know, Broadway's this multi-billion-dollar tourist business. Hooray! We make $1 million every time we go to sleep at night. And also, I was interested in the struggle. I mean, people have asked me, you know, you end when Bernie and Jerry die and Disney comes on the scene. Are you going to tell the next part of the book when Disney dominates and you have these big successful shows like Wicked and Jersey Boys and Mamma Mia? And I said, no, that's not for me. I'm mindful of something that the great director Michael Blakemore told me when he wrote his memoir called Arguments with England, which is one of the great theater books. And it's about his struggle to make it in the London theater scene. And I asked him, and he ends when he has his first West End hit, which is The Day in the Death of Joe Egg. And I said, so are you going to do the second part of your memoirs? And he said, no, because the struggle's interesting. Once you've made it, then it just becomes how much money I made, how many houses I own, what my new car is like. And I thought, well, that's kind of it. I don't have much to say about how much money Disney and the people behind Wicked and people behind Mamma Mia have made in the 90s and the 2000s. I was interested in a time when Broadway, the city, and Times Square were really in trouble, and how they were turned around, and the impact that the influence, the contribution that Broadway and the people who work on Broadway made to saving the city. The struggle is where the drama is. And so that's the tale I wanted to tell.
Maybe, it might not be a whole book, but I'd love to read a long form story on Fran and Barry from you.
Well, they're very colorful characters, Fran and Barry Weissel. Yeah, they're great. They're great. You know, I think I've actually encouraged them to work on a memoir, a joint memoir. And, mm-hmm. I've heard Fran give speeches, and she's great. She's a great storyteller, and she really concentrates again on the struggle. I mean, they came from nothing, and you know, they sit on the top of the world with the success of Chicago. But I'll leave it to them to tell their story.
I want to. I read something this week which stunned me into thinking for a few minutes, and I'm going to read you this little excerpt, and I'll get your feedback on this. The quote is, I appreciate that times are tough for print media, but I think it's both irresponsible and short-sighted to diminish an industry that many consider to be the lifeblood of New York City, Broadway publicist Rick Miramontes told Deadline. That said, only having to endure Michael Riedel once a week will make many of my colleagues and clients happy, I'm sure. How did you get Rick Miramontis to come to your defense?
Well, Rick,
and let everybody in. Listeners might not know who Rick is, so to explain who Rick is.
Well, we should say he was responding to the fact that I used to have a column twice a week, Wednesday and Friday in the Post, and now I have just a Friday column. And Rick was responding to that change, and also responding to the fact that the Daily News has completely devastated its arts and entertainment division, laid off 25 people not too long ago. Uh-huh. I mean, Rick is great with a cheeky quote, and we've been friends for years, but I do have to say it's not quite accurate that I've been cut back. What has happened at the Post is that we've redesigned our section. So each day is a different theme. So Mondays, it's, travel. Tuesday is health and fitness. Wednesday is dining. Thursday is relationships. And Friday is entertainment. So they've given me a full page on Friday. So I have the same number of words each week that I had with two columns, only now they come together in one column in our entertainment section on Fridays. So in many ways, I've gone back to what I started doing when I began at the Post. I had a big page on Friday, and then they split it up over time because they redesigned the paper back then. So I'm basically, I am the last of the Broadway columnists. There's no other, none of the other newspapers in this town have a weekly Broadway column. I really am the end of the line of the Walter Winchells, and the Dorothy Kilgallens, and the Ed Sullivans, who, man, people forget this, but Ed Sullivan was a Broadway columnist before he became a TV personality. Mm-hmm. And, Friday, the New York Times discontinued its Friday column years ago. And when I left the Daily News years ago, they never replaced me with a theater columnist, and Newsday got rid of its theater column a long time ago. So pretty much you can stuff me and stick me in the Museum of the History of the City as the last Broadway columnist, which is, I think, kind of sad because it was a great tradition of newspaper men who covered Broadway.
Hmm. Well, Michael, thank you for giving us an hour of your time. I really appreciate it. Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, is available everywhere you can get it. And Michael, will you have any book signings where people can come down and get your signature?
Well, I had one recently at Barnes & Noble, and now I'm about to go on a book tour. So I leave on Wednesday for about a week and a half to hit some of the big cities in the West Coast. So you can see me in, if you go on the Simon Schuster website, they list all the places I'm going to be. But you can see me in the coming weeks at Denver, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Portland.
Well, I will put a link to the Simon Schuster website with your schedule in our show notes for our listeners. Get out to see Michael. Please go out and buy this book and support him because, you know, the newspaper business is very tough. He might be unemployed tomorrow. So,
yes, well, that's why I've taken to writing books, because Peter, as a fellow author, you know how much money there is in writing books.
Absolutely.
As we talk to Peter from his pied-à-terre in south of France. So,
thank you, guys.
All right. You have a great time, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so let's do our periodic, hopefully monthly, roundup of television and film as it relates to Broadway. And Matt Tamanini is going to give us a rundown. So, Matt, what's happening with The Wiz?
Well, The Wiz rehearsals are in full swing. You're seeing a lot of publicity materials and pictures coming out. A lot of the friends, as they're being called, Dorothy and her friends in costume. So that's always fun. There was a little bit of news this week in terms of the songs that are included, because Harvey Fierstein is reworking the script a little bit, and it looks like there's going to be some material incorporated from the movie, the song You Can't Win, which was actually cut from the Broadway version and then sung by Michael Jackson's Scarecrow in the movie. That's going to be sung by Elijah Kelly, who's playing the Scarecrow in The Wiz Live. So that's kind of neat for people who for the eight people that enjoyed the movie version of The Wiz to get to see that. Also, something that's a little more suspect is the hip-hop artist Neo, who's playing the Tin Man. He apparently is writing a new song for the show. We haven't really heard where that's going to be incorporated into the production, whether that's going to be, you know, in the normal book narrative of the show, or if it'll be maybe something to play at the beginning or during the end credits. But Neo is writing a new song for The Wiz Live, whatever that means at this point.
So if they write a new song, will it be Emmy eligible then?
That's a good point. It probably would be. It's a little different criteria than like the Oscars, Academy, where we see, you know, them writing random songs and sticking them in there just for Oscar eligibility, but I'm sure it would be. I mean, that's, I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. That's pretty interesting.
And remind listeners when The Wiz is going to be playing.
That is going to be December 3rd on NBC. It will be live on the East Coast at 8 o'clock and then tape delayed in the other time zones.
All right. And do you know if there's any chance of it playing internationally?
I don't know. They did announce that they would be – they already announced that it will be re-airing as they have with Peter Pan and Sound of Music. But I'm not sure if it'll be international yet. I guess that's a check your local listings kind of situation.
All right. And the upcoming Grease production that's going to be on Fox, is it?
It is Fox. This one's starting to take shape. We heard a lot more about The Wiz early on. The Grease Live is going to be on Fox on January 31st of 2016. So it is rapidly approaching. We've learned a lot more about the casting, and we're starting to be able to glean some information about what this is going to look like. With the casting, one of the things that kind of jumped out at me, and I'll get to some of the other ones, is that David Del Rio, who replaced Robin DeJesus as Sonny in The Heights, his casting is great to have a Broadway person on there. But the role he's playing kind of shows you a little bit about where this is going. He will be playing Putzy. So if you are familiar with the stage version, you know there is no T-Bird named Putzy in the stage version. However, that is the character of Roger, how he was named in the movie version. So I think what this is telling us is that while The Sound of Music Live and Peter Pan Live over on NBC have kind of stuck closer to the stage versions, I have a feeling we're going to see more of the Grease movie from this. Now, that being said, the stage script of Grease gets revised about every 3 or 4 years whenever they bring a new revival. So who knows what that means. But I thought that was kind of interesting in terms of the casting, that they did straight up go with one of the characters' names from the movie as opposed to the stage version. We've also had some other pretty interesting Broadway-related casting. Carly Rae Jepsen, who did a stint in Cinderella a few years ago, will be playing Frenchie. Ellie McLemore from Bring It On, the musical, and Heather's, the musical, she'll be playing everybody's favorite cheerleader yet again, Patty Simcox. Mario Lopez, while some Broadway people know him from A Chorus Line, he'll always be A.C. Slater to me. He will be Vince Fontaine. And then Noah Robbins, who was in the recent, I guess not recent all that much anymore, but the Broadway revivals over the last decade of Arcadia and the Brighton Beach Memoirs, he will be playing Eugene. So there's quite a few Broadway connections in the cast. British pop singer Jesse J is going to sing Grease is the Word to open the show, a la Frankie Valli in the movie. There are still some major parts that haven't been cast. Sonny, the T-Bird Sonny, Miss Lynch, or if they go with the movie version again, Principal McGee hasn't been cast. Cha-Cha DeGregorio and the Teen Angel haven't been cast yet, although there are rumors for a lot of these characters. Everyone from Nick Jonas to Olivia Newton-John to Martin Short are being rumored to have parts in the show. So I'd imagine with rehearsals starting somewhere in the first 2 weeks of November that we should be getting a little more information in the coming days and weeks.
And also in the news this week is the talk about the casting in the Rocky Horror Show of Frank.
Yeah, the Fox announced both Grease Live and Rocky Horror pretty much at the same time, but they announced a specific date for Grease right away, and then they kind of never really cemented a date for Rocky Horror, but we did find out this week that it's going to be fall 2016, so a little less than a year from now, and they did cast Dr. Frankenfurter with Laverne Cox. For people who don't know Laverne Cox, she plays Sophie Bursett on Orange is the New Black, and last year she became the first transgender person ever nominated for an Emmy, so the casting is pretty interesting for this part, and not only is she an African-American woman, but to be transgender and to play this part of the sweet transvestite is pretty cool. So I'm excited to see what that means for the rest of the casting. If we're going to base the timetable on casting for Rocky Horror off the timetable for Grease, I'd imagine we'd start to get a few more pieces of information of bigger name people now that we're about a year out, which is what Grease did with Juliana Huff and Vanessa Hudgens. And then as we get closer, some more things will trickle out. But this is a pretty interesting first salvo into the casting. So it'll be interesting to see where they go from there.
Do you think they're going to push Rocky Horror later into the evening as a more adult thing than family fare?
Well, I don't think they can, and here's why. Fox has already said it's going to be a two-hour event, and for people who watch a lot of Fox, they know that Fox only has 2 hours in prime time. They only have from 8 to 10, and then the local news on Fox's in the local markets air at 10 o'clock. So they really only have the 8 to 10 o'clock time slot unless they work something out with the local markets, which I just don't see happening. That is such a huge issue that would be unprecedented. So I'm imagining we're going to get an 8 to 10 with strong parental suggestions.
So, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong. You grew up in the heart of America, in the Ohio area.
I did. A Columbus, Ohio native, yes.
And is it more conservative than the East Coast? And I wonder, what do you think? Is there going to be any pushbacks in the affiliates? Sometimes the affiliates get crazy. Sure. Not specifically Ohio, but other television affiliates in the middle of the country push back on things that show.
Yeah, I would say Ohio is probably not as conservative as some of the other places more in the central part of the country and the plains. Yeah, and I did live in Kansas for a year, and that would be far more conservative. It'll be interesting. I think that this is such a known property that I think especially if they time it with Halloween next year, which they very well might do, it might not get as much pushback, but in a vacuum, I would imagine the content of Rocky Horror Show on TV would draw some ire from certain parental councils that often make noise on things like this. I just kind of assume at this point that Rocky Horror is so well known that I wouldn't imagine we would get a whole lot of news out of that.
All right. All right. So tell me about what's happening at the BBC.
Well, staying with Rocky Horror, there is a current Rocky Horror tour going on in the UK, and BBC America will be broadcasting a special production of that on Halloween night. So it's actually at midnight on Halloween night, so it's technically November 1st. I had to double check that because the whole midnight thing always throws me for a loop. But it is the current UK touring production. Rocky Horror creator Richard O'Brien is going to actually play the narrator in this, and he's got some other British celebrities to come in and play the narrator. There are some clips online of Baby Spice Emma Bunton doing some of the narrator bit and doing a song. Other people like Stephen Fry and Anthony Head are involved as well. So it'll be cool to kind of get a little look at Rocky Horror on TV before we wait for our American version about a year later.
All right. And tell us more about Live from Lincoln Center.
Yeah, we've got some good stage productions that have happened recently and coming up. We've seen in the last few weeks Billy Elliot Live and Showboat from New York Phil with Norm Lewis, Vanessa Williams, Leia Salonga, Lauren Worsham, Julian Ovendien. You can check your local listing for Billy Elliot and Showboat. Those could still be playing in your area depending on your PBS schedule. However, coming up on November 13th is the Broadway production of Act One, starring Tony Shalhoub, Andrea Martin, that, yeah. Santino Fontana, the story of Moss Hart, directed in and adapted by James Lapine. So that'll be a good one to see, a recent Broadway show on PBS. And that's one of the great things about Live from Lincoln Center that you really can't get anywhere else on TV, and one of the valuable things that PBS provides that you don't see on any of the other supposed arts channels that have gone by the wayside on cable television.
All right. And we seem to have a lot of Broadway stars on TV coming up. So why don't you run us through some of those?
Yeah, I think you said this is going to come out on Monday, October 26th. So that means tonight is the series premiere of Supergirl on CBS. And while, you know, you don't hear think of Supergirl as being a Broadway property, they do have a lot of musical theater carryover in this. Starring as Supergirl is Melissa Benoist, who starred in Glee and Whiplash, the Academy Award winning film last year. But then some of her peripheral characters are Broadway favorites. Jeremy Jordan, who plays one of her co-workers, and actually – one of the first people she tells that she is Supergirl, and then playing Supergirl's Kryptonian mother is everybody's favorite Tony winner, Laura Benanti. So so that's a lot of fun. And I will say I've seen the pilot that'll air tomorrow night or Monday night. And Laura Benanti's part as the mother is a little more involved than you would think just from the Supergirl mythos. So if you're a Laura Benanti fan, it'll be important for you to check this one out. Then sticking with CBS, that airs it on CBS. CBS tends to be the network for whatever reason. Maybe I think more shows on CBS tape in New York than others, but there's a lot of good Broadway stars always on CBS shows, especially on The Good Wife, the episode that is going to air on the 25th. So on Sunday, the 25th, will star Peter Gallagher. He's actually starting as in a recurring role. He'll be teamed up with Christine Baranski's character on a physician-assisted suicide case. And actually, Peter Gallagher is also joining the cast of Law & Order this season. And Andy Carl just recently joined him in a recurring role as his son. So Andy Carl and Peter Gallagher were just seen on Broadway and on the 20th Century. And now they're playing father and son on Law & Order SVU. So always check in with that. There really isn't been anything better for the TV careers of Broadway performers than the Law & Order franchise. So it's good to see that that's still happening. And actually, on this Thursday's episode, Christopher Sieber from currently in Matilda, and then Geneva Carr currently in Hand to God, they will star as, you gotta love SVU, they will star in a Duggar family inspired episode that it can only be equally funny and creepy in a way that only SVU can do. So that's fun. And Andy Carl will be actually playing one of the detectives leading up that case. So that'll be fun to see them. Maybe Andy Carl and Christopher Sieber will break out in song at some point. There's a couple more shows coming up. This Dick Wolf, who is the creator of the Law & Order franchise, now that Law & Order, for the most part, has wound down other than SVU, he started up a Chicago series of shows with Chicago Fire and Chicago PD. The third installment, Chicago Med, kicks off on November 17th, also on NBC. And that's going to star Colin Donnell, Oliver Platt, and Essa Paytha Merkerson, all Broadway faves. So that'll be fun to see them. Then another show that just had some big casting announcements that will start in this summer of 2016 is a show called Brain Dead, also on CBS, and that's going to star Aaron Tveit and Nikki M. James. So some big-time young Broadway stars transitioning over to TV. It's said to be a comic thriller that has part politics and part medical intrigue, but it is a little bit of a comedy. So I'm hoping that with a show title named Brain Dead that we get some zombies. I don't know. There hasn't been a whole lot released, but I'm a big zombie fan. So I'm hoping that Aaron Tveit and Nikki M. James can end up being zombie hunters in some form or fashion.
All right. What about Madam Secretary?
Madam Secretary is one that always has some guest stars. In its regular cast, you've got everyone from B.B. Newworth, you've got Patina Miller, you've got Eric Bergen. They're always – and Stephanie J. Block's husband, Sebastian Arculus. I don't even know if that's pronounced correctly. You probably know better than I do. He's in the cast. So they've always got a great Broadway folks. In fact, if you haven't seen it, a couple episodes ago, it was kind of at a big Washington, D.C. fundraiser. Patina Miller, B.B. Newworth, and Eric Bergen, they sang a reworked parody of Billy Joel's song. Was it For the Longest Time? I think it was For the Longest Time. So if you haven't seen that and you like those performers, which most Broadway folks do, that's really cool to check out. It's kind of nice to see the three of them harmonizing on a Billy Joel song on national television.
I forgot to ask you before, do you know if Chicago Med is shot in New York?
No, all three of those Chicago shows are actually shot in Chicago. So all of those folks have relocated to Chicago for filming.
Okay. And Neil Patrick Harris's show Best Time Ever, how's that doing and what do you think about it?
That first episode, if you followed Twitter during that first episode, you saw everything from high praise to the worst forms of insults that you could imagine for a show. But I think that speaks to what that show really is. I've checked it out from here and there, but I know a lot of people, everyone from my parents to people younger than me, that love the show. It is such a kooky variety show that has everything from people jumping off buildings with celebrities to random fathers dancing shirtless to embarrass their families on national television. You can do that. There you go. The dad bod is very popular right now, James. But then you've got I watched an episode where a woman was pulled up on stage, didn't really know what was going on. And then Neil showed a video of her boyfriend doing all these crazy things that she had no idea that he had done, traveling different parts of the country and doing little bits. And then it ended up with a proposal on stage. Uh-oh. So it's just a really fun thing. He always seems to have some sort of 1970s disco act there. Everyone from Gloria Gaynor. I think the Weather Girls sang It's Raining Men at one point. So it's been a really interesting show. And the ratings have been pretty good. It changed time slots, which was – a lot of people just assumed that was because it wasn't doing well in its time slot. That was actually always the plan, was to move from 10 o'clock to 8 o'clock when more shows – joined the schedule, but it's done well, and it's a show that, to be honest with you, I kind of thought it was a long shot to have success just because of how random it was. It's based on a BBC format of variety show that we just don't have here in the United States, and it's been, got to be honest, more successful than I thought it would be. And anytime you can see Neil Patrick Harris on TV, I'm fine with that.
Is he having any focus on Broadway? I mean, they're shooting in New York.
They are shooting in New York, but and like I said, I've only checked in here and there, but I haven't heard anything or seen anything in the episodes that I've seen, other than having, maybe I think there might have been a Gloria Stefan was on this past week, I think, and I'm sure they mentioned On Your Feet coming to Broadway, but that, as far as I know, that's the closest Broadway connection they've had so far.
Is there anything that's up and coming that we should alert our listeners to?
There is a lot of good stage shows coming to movie theaters across the country here in the next few weeks to celebrate the film version of Oklahoma's 60th anniversary. It is coming back to theaters on November 1st, and it's a little interesting. At the beginning, I'm not sure if that'll be before the curtain, the scheduled curtain time, or maybe if you go to see a lot of these things, they often have some pre-features going on, but Tony Winner and Emmy Winner and Oklahoma native Kristen Chenoweth is going to be doing some song performances that were filmed at 54 Below. So anytime you can see Kristen sing, it's a good thing, even if it is on the big screen, which we really haven't gotten a chance to see all that much. So if you're an Oklahoma fan, definitely check your local theaters to see where that's playing. So that should be pretty cool. There's been some videos released of her doing some of the songs ahead of time, kind of to get the word out. But that should be really cool. And then a couple days later, on November 3rd, the West End production, the recent West End production of The Importance of Being Earnest, starring David Suchet, will be playing in theaters. If you're unfamiliar with David Suchet, he played Hercule Poirot for, heck, I think 25 years, I think, is what it was, on the BBC's Hercule Poirot Mysteries. He'll be playing Lady Bracknell, which is I don't know when that was. I think it was just with the recent Broadway revival that came from London, that Lady Bracknell is now always played by a man. I don't know when that happened, but he will be playing Lady Bracknell. And then, based on the huge success that happened earlier this fall, on November 10th, NT Live, National Theatre Live, is bringing back Benedict Cumberbatch's Hamlet from the Barbican. That'll be reshown again on November 10th. So that's always fun. I missed it the first time, so I was scrambling to find other times that it is coming out, and then they eventually announced that it was coming back to theaters, so that's fun. And then NT Live also has a production of Coriolanus that will be coming up this fall as well. I didn't write down the the date on that. I'll grab that. But that stars Olivier Winter and Marvel villain Tom Hiddleston and Hadley Fraser. And that one will be let me go back to my notes. That'll be on November 12th. So Coriolanus, November 12th. And then finally coming up at the end of November on the 30th, Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale starring Dame Judi Dench, Kenneth Branagh, and Hadley Fraser will also be in theater. So a lot of good classic theater coming to movie screens across the country. So that's always fun, and it makes for a good night out for theater fans.
Matt, do you have a roundup on Broadway World that we can point our listeners to see what's coming up?
We do. We have a stage and screen section that I think has
a calendar. Sure
it has, yeah, it has a calendar with all that. It also has some information on the TV musicals and stuff as well.
All right. Send me that link. I'll put it in the show notes. So if you're listening and there's a lot of stuff that just went by, maybe you can get over to BroadwayRadio.com, click on the link, and see all the stuff that Matt and the team over at Broadway World has compiled for what's coming up on TV and film. So that kind of wraps up the TV and film section. Matt, how are your Ohio State Buckeyes doing?
They're the number one team in the country, undefeated. We've made a quarterback change that has made quite the difference despite having a 21-game win streak. We look like a brand-new team, beating Rutgers last night, so I apologize to any Rutgers alums in the New York listening area. But we ended up winning, I think it was 49-7, so we'll take it. I mean, you know, we'll take it.
Big games coming up, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan State, and Michigan. That's a tough end of the season.
We don't use that word. That last one, we don't use that word.
The M word.
The M word. It is the school up north or that team up north. We never use that word during football season. So I'll forgive you this time, James. You're not a native Ohioan, so we'll overlook it.
Well, you beat my Penn State Nittany Lions pretty good, 38-10. So
I wasn't going to bring it up. There are quite a few Broadway World staffers who are either we have a our managing editor Nicole is a Broadway or is a Penn State alum and. Our features editor, Karen Robbins, her daughter is a freshman at Penn State. So we had some fun conference calls leading up to that game. So I tried not to rub it in too much afterwards.
All right, Matt. Well, thanks so much for joining us on Broadway Radio. And, you know, come back in November and tell us what's going on.
Anytime you want.
Okay, so let's get into our reviews for the morning. Michael and Peter both got a chance to trek out to the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, New Jersey, and see Bandstand. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is the world's first post-traumatic stress disorder musical. It it is. It deals with a guy who comes back from the war. And
World War II, mind you.
Yes, good point.
Oh, yes. It actually is.
Too many wars, yeah, good point.
Well, it's just part of the point of it is that people didn't really use that term then.
That's fair. That's exactly right. That didn't come up till the Vietnam War. So, but this is a nice reminder that people who came back from any war were having trouble readjusting. And we're most concerned with Donnie Nowicki, who wants to start a band and become successful. And that's part of the problem. It's much more about his wanting success than it is about his coming to terms with what happened in the war. Now, some of the other members of the band have problems, too, as a result of being in war. And we touch upon those very, very lightly because most of the time is spent about this guy wanting to get ahead. He reminded me very much of Robert De Niro's character, Jimmy Doyle, in New York, New York, the type of guy who will not take no for an answer, the guy who has to have everything his own way. Well, anyway, he also had a buddy who died in the war, and now he goes to meet the widow and decides that she's going to be in the band too. So, and he's much more concerned about the fact that she be there and be a good singer than he is about her concerns that she has as a war widow. Now, I think they're missing a great opportunity here, and I'm going to tell you what I think should happen right away. Mm-hmm. It should be much more about his wanting to help her and her mother, by the way. Beth Lebel playing a very small role, but playing it well. Laura Osnes, by the way, is very good, but she doesn't have all that much to do either as the war widow. No, we're really concerned about Donnie, and he's played by Corey Cott wonderfully, a galvanically fine performance. Nothing wrong with what he's doing. It's what he's been given to say that's the problem. Okay, well, here's the thing. my suggestion would be that he must be much more concerned about helping the war widow and the mother. And it would be such an easy thing to do, because what they could stress is these women had jobs during the war, and now suddenly they don't, because men have come back from the war. And so if he wanted to be noble and use the success of the band to help them, I think that would be a very, very good move for this show. Music's fine. Richard Oberacker, very good composer. And he and Robert Taylor did the book and the lyrics, which, as I say, are less successful. I'm getting a little tired of seeing this unit set at Paper Mill. This is the third show in a row. It's almost the same set. Things that come out of the wings and little things that pop out here and there. So it's Andy Blankenbuehler directed very slickly. It moves very, very well. There is dancing that's of the jitterbug nature that you pretty much would you'd expect to see. It's not inspired, but it's right. So that's perfectly in tune, too. So there's one band member who has really the most severe problem, and he's handled very, very beautifully in the show. And I become more interested in him because I'm concerned about his problems and getting over it, while Donnie seems to be over it. And that's and so I want to give a shout out to Joe Carroll, plays that part very, very nicely. And the fact that I'm drawn to him more than Donnie says that there is something wrong with the show. It is fixable. I hope they fix it. But we got to care more about this guy. We've got to care more about this girl. And it can't just be about making it in show business.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I agree with every word Peter
really?
Said. Yep.
Oh, wow.
Here's an interesting fact. It's interesting what you hear when hear people talk who are in the know. Do you know, Peter, that apparently when we saw the show, I believe it was just about 2.5 hours, including the intermission. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
As of like two nights before, it was 3 hours.
Really?
Yes. And someone made an absolute point of that because they had seen it more than once at 3 hours. So they really did major surgery. And I guess that when it's done that quickly, that can be
yes,
good,
it can.
But it can also result in certain things that might have been smooth over if they had some more time. I basically agree about the Corey Cott character. I thought he was, although I hasten to say, still much more likable than De Niro in New York, New York.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've discussed that.
Oh, yeah.
Before. I really liked the show in the beginning, and for most of the first act, I thought Andy Blankenbuehler's work was stellar. I also liked the way the songwriters, to me, the music was pastiche, when it need, you know, it was creditably pastiche. It did sound to me like, you know, more or less like music of the time, the swing and the pop music of the World War II, post-World War II era. But then there were a couple of numbers that were out of time, and they were much less effective. I thought Beth Level had one or two of those. I got the impression, hearkening back to what I just said, that maybe her role had been considerably larger. I don't know that for sure, but it seemed like she did not really have that much to do. And I thought that I love the idea of the show, and I love the arc of it and the basic idea, but I think that the lyrics themselves were really not that great, and including using expressions and terms that are really not of the period, and that always took me out of it. If you're going to deal with the PTSD, I think that's fantastic. I think that's a worthy subject. But the way they did it sounded like they were doing it in a, you know, in a 21st century way, not in the mid 20th. So I do agree. Completely fixable. If they could just have another pass it in and take more time. Other thing I noticed, did you notice that Laura Osnes's character, and I always love her, I think she's just great. Yes. But did you notice that every idea that that Donnie, Nowitzki came up with. Every single idea he came up with, she said no. Mm-hmm. She was every single, even the, mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing for her to not agree to change her last name, even though it's Trojan.
Yeah.
You know, which when did you ever hear of anyone whose last name was Trojan? But so that took me out of it too. But her married name of her dead husband is Trojan. So she doesn't want to change it because it's her dead husband and she wants to remember him. So I can understand her not wanting to change that name, even though it is that name. But then every idea he had about forming the band, moving it forward, how they were going to proceed, she was no. And then every time he would make some move that indicated that he was interested in her, she was very negative about that. And then every single thing that she said no to, then she changed her mind in like a scene or two later. So I think they really need to work on that character a little bit more.
Well, also, I'm going to quote three lines here.
Okay.
From her. If you're going to be a band leader, you're going to have to learn how to talk to people. Parents should warn their kids about people like you. You have a habit of saying things the wrong way. Now, again, you know, we are hearing somebody's observation here on those are three of them, and they're all negative in terms of who he is. And unfortunately, she also has a point in the fact that he is hard to take. I want to segue. Robert De Niro, by the way, leads me to something completely different. And before I forget, I really want to mention this because I think this will be of interest to people. You may know that when John Kander and Fred Ebb wrote New York, New York for the movie that Robert De Niro and Liza Minnelli would be in, De Niro said they came in with a song and De Niro says, no, that song's not. That's no good. You can do better than that. And they went and they wrote the song We Know, New York, New York. So we have Robert De Niro to thank for that song that we know, New York, New York. However, Harbinger Records is putting out a set of John Kander demos and recordings, and what will be on that album will be the original New York, New York. So we will have a chance to hear whether or not that New York, New York is a song that we like better, which I guess is doubtful. But anyway, you'll have a chance to hear what they came up with before Robert De Niro said, no, go back and work. I know that's a complete getting away from what we're talking about, and I apologize, but I would think that that would be of interest because I'm looking forward to hearing that song.
Yes. And one final thing on Bandstand. I completely agree about Joe Carroll. He was so compelling, so appealing in that role. And it was, I think it was a very well-written role. So yes, on both counts.
Mm. All right. So the Bandstand's playing at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millbrook, New Jersey through November 8th. And hopefully they'll get a chance to rework that and we'll see it again on another stage, maybe on this side of the river.
For what it's worth, it seems to me that it has gotten very good response overall, considerably better than what Peter and I just said. So
Yeah, that's true. Yes, that's fair.
We shall see. But
were you there at the opening?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah, that audience went crazy for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right, next up, Michael got over to the Ars Nova Theater to see Romance Language. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
This is another frequent case of a play that had a really good concept, like Bandstand, but the execution was unfortunately not as good as it could have been. It's a new play by Joe Godfrey, three-person cast. We have Audrey Hepburn and Meyer playing Kay, who is a middle-aged, obviously wealthy Manhattan woman who decides that she is going to get back into life. And the way she decides to do that is she hires a very attractive young man to give her Italian lessons in her home. And her husband, by the way, is dead, but they had been separated or divorced. I can't remember now, before his death. So that there are a lot of issues involved in that, especially when Kay's daughter, Penny, shows up, played by Marin Lee. And by the way, the young Italian instructor, his name is Fiore, and he's played by Jared Zarrilli in a really amazing performance. Jared Zarrilli, I've seen in a few other things, just a few. He was in Pretty Filthy, which I didn't like that so much, but he was great in that also. He, I don't know. I mean, his name sounds Italian, so I imagine he's got the background, but his accent really sounded absolutely perfect to me, and he looked the part just great. So the in a nutshell, what happens is that Kay and Fiore wind up becoming attracted to each other. She actually makes the first move in inviting him to the opera with her, and he's very happy to do that. It's the point is made that he, you know, he is not have a lot of money, and he doesn't really have a full time job. He's just giving these Italian lessons. So they start to become close, even though there's quite a bit of an age difference. And then the daughter shows up and immediately assumes that Fiore is a gigolo and is just after her mother's money. So the bulk of the play is trying to figure out whether or not that is true. But it's complicated by the fact that it turns out that Penny, the daughter, has a lot of daddy issues, a lot of issues in the regarding the failed relationship between her mother and her now dead father. So so actually, the good thing about the play is that we really don't know. And even at the end, we are not entirely sure if Fiore is a gigolo or if the daughter is has engineered things and maybe lied about things in order to try to get him out of her mother's life. And I really liked all that very much. I just thought it was quite repetitive and could have been shorter, and some of the dialogue was rather clunky. But here again, I not unfixable. And I do look forward to more work by Joe Godfrey. I just, you know, I think maybe some more time spent, a few more drafts through would really improve it.
All right. So Romance Language is at Ars Nova on 54th Street, and it's also running through November 8th, so check it out if this interests you. Peter and Michael got a chance to see Trip of Love at Stage 42, which is the former Little Schubert. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did I get that correct?
Yes.
And so both of you got a chance to see it, so Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, because the baby boomers were busy in their youth with sex, drugs, and rock and roll and political concern, they passed up seeing floor shows at nightclubs like the Latin Quarter, the Copa, the Diamond Horseshoe, you know. So now those places are long gone, but boomers are now late middle-aged, and that's probably a euphemism. So if they feel they missed something by not going to the Latin Quarter, the Copa, the Diamond Horseshoe, they have a second chance now to see a showgirl studded review, and you don't have to pay the dinner charge or the two-drink minimum at Trip of Love. When you look at the director's note, you see the problem immediately with this show, because he starts off talking about, you know, we don't have reviews anymore. There used to be times like Bubbling Brown Sugar, and those were the good old days. Okay, fine. Fine. The very next paragraph, and I'm quoting now, there was a time when Broadway was filled with review style shows. Fine. Okay. Now, then he says, I want to get it right. Okay. Where am I? Trip of Love follows a young girl and her dream after falling down the rabbit hole and taking a magic mushroom. The cast of characters and the story is her creation in her dream. Okay, now, when you start off saying it's to review, review implies no story. Then you talk about the story that they've created. You know, what is this a review or isn't it? You know, and so that dichotomy is really a big problem, because you could have fooled me that this was about a girl who fell down a rabbit hole and took a magic mushroom. It just seemed like a review to me, one song after the other. The one thing I do want to point out about Trip of Love is that, unlike Smokey Joe's Cafe, where you went and you basically saw a back wall and a fire escape and little sets moving on here and there. Wow, did they throw money at this thing? I'll tell you, virtually every scene has a completely different backdrop. Much of it seems electronic. And wow. I mean, it's not really that it knocks your eyes out as much as you say, wow, they really spent money there, didn't they? So it's not cheap. I understand it cost $11 million. I'm not saying I'm right about that, but that's what I've heard. So it doesn't look like $11 million to me, I'll tell you. But nevertheless, it certainly was not done on the cheap when it could have been. We wouldn't have thought anything of having one unit set and people coming out and singing one song after the other. The people are fine, especially a woman named Laurie Wells, who sort of looks like Stockard Channing. Oh, you thought so too? Oh, how funny. You know, I mean, looking like Stockard Channing, you know, younger and before the facelift. But, you know, I mean, she has a very nice voice, very solid. She has a very nice way about her. And she gets to sing songs like Both Sides Now and The Windmills of Your Mind, because we are going back into that era of the baby boomer songs. But they're not particularly done in the way that we heard them on the recordings. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, and you expect that from a review. She's very good, too, on If You Go Away. But, you know, here's the thing. Wow. If You Go Away, she's singing, and above her on platforms are two men who strip down to their skivvies. You know, I guess, you know, they're not going away. You know, I mean, they've gotten this invitation from her, you know, so, but no sooner do they get down to their tidy whities than they start dressing again. I don't know if that means that, you know, they just finished, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. You know, if they just finished, I don't know what it's supposed to mean. But you know, again, this is just a dream, you know, so, and that's such a convenient thing to do, because in a dream, anything can happen. And that's why you can justify, you know, I can see people going up to this James Walski and saying, well, this doesn't make sense. Hey, it's just a dream, you know, and that way you get away with it. A woman comes on and sings, "You Don't Own Me." And we don't know who you is, but then I guess you comes on, and for a few seconds she sings to him, and then he sings What Becomes of the Brokenhearted, so I guess he's brokenhearted. But I don't know if I'm on his side or her side. So it's not as terrible as I'm making it sound. It really isn't. You know, I mean, it just sits there. You sit, you watch, you listen, you go home. I was at a party the other night. And a woman came up to me and told me she had seen, said, you know, it was good to hear the old songs again. And if you can go with that vantage point, you know, of hearing the old songs again, you're going to be all right. But the other thing is, of course, because it's the 60s, they decide to bring in some political issues. And one of those, like, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, if you know that song, and the woman who sings the line, "Gone to graveyards everywhere," just won't stop smiling any more than Ina Penmark does in Ruthless after she's killed Kid. I mean, it's just amazing to me how she's smiling while singing this, so she doesn't know what the lyric means. So, and, you know, given the show that is called Trip of Love, they would have gotten away with not having to deal with the political stuff. And I think they would have been better off, because otherwise you just say, gee, you remember how good that song was. And, you know, when you bring the political stuff to it, you got to remember that this was a tumultuous time. And there were a lot of no jokes during this period of time. So I don't think a show called Trip of Love is under any responsibility to deal with this. And I think that's one of the places they went wrong. But anyway, you're not going to feel you didn't get your money's worth in terms of what your eyes see.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Again, I agree with every word.
Yeah?
Oh. I think that there was actually a number that was actually set in Vietnam. I believe it was Blowing in the Wind, where the two guys were sitting on each side of the stage, and obviously they were supposed to be there. Yeah, I think their tremendous mistake was attempting to have any kind of a story, whether, you know, even as ridiculous as it may be in that note you read, and whether, you know, and if they were going to have one. I mean, really, the shifts from incredibly lighthearted songs like Downtown and it's not unusual to the, you know, Where Have All the Flowers Gone and these anti-war peace songs. It's done so badly that you're like, are you serious? I wish he hadn't done that. I think this fellow, James Walski, the credit is created, mm-hmm. directed, and choreographed. I think another eye was needed, you know? Mm-hmm. I really do. And this show, actually, it made me sad more than anything because there was so much talent on stage. And I think the choreography, although to use a word you use, I think, for Bandstand, it's not like innovative, but it's not supposed to be. I think the choreography for what it was supposed to be is excellent. And the performance of it is beyond great. That's one of the hardest working casts ever. Mm-hmm. A shout out to David Elder, who we know from, among other things, the 42nd Street Revival and Titanic. Still singing and dancing and looking like $1 million as George. Also Austin Miller from Grease Live, if anyone remembers that TV reality show. And Laurie Wells, yeah, I thought she had an absolutely beautiful voice. Although some of her phrasing bothered me, I would have said, you know, can you maybe sing some of those note values the way they're written? But I don't know if that was her choice or not. Also Joey Calvary, who's been in a few things, Dion Figgins, Tara Palsha, and this Kelly Felthaus, I guess that was her, right? Caroline?
Yeah.
Whose vocal resemblance to Kristen Chenoweth was absolutely freakish, I thought. And I know two other people who agreed with me, so I guess I wasn't hearing things. Kristen in her lower register, there was no soprano in this, so we didn't get to hear that. But she sounded so much like her and even looked a little bit like her.
A little.
That was great. But yeah, I was sorry that this show came from Japan. Did you mention that?
No.
Which I guess partly explains the money, and I guess also partly explains why Hal Prince is now in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point.
Mm-hmm. The projections are state-of-the-art, mind-boggling, Radio City Music Hall Christmas spectacular level. The sets also are very, very extensive and elaborate. One of the other things about the show is that there were a few things in it that I thought were so tasteless that they brought down the level of the whole thing. So if those things had been cut, that would have been that would have made me feel better. The set piece they used at the beginning and the end, I guess to represent the rabbit hole, to me just looked like a big vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one point where the end of Act One is Moon River, and I guess the aforementioned Laurie Wells. We're supposed to be seeing the wedding of Adam and Caroline, but in the meantime, Laurie Wells' Angela is sitting on a swing that's hanging from the flies, and it's like, really, you know. So there were a few things that were really tasteless. I love the costumes, you know, as over the top as they were, but there again, if there had not been any serious content in the show, it would have been easier. It would have been easier to take because then you wouldn't have questioned some of the things that were really over the top and maybe not in great taste. So I felt sad and a little angry that there hadn't been another eye to help this James Walski in putting this piece together, because I think that would have helped tremendously.
Michael mentioned Adam and Angela and whoever the other one was. They all have names. They're not just there are actors' names in the programs. They all have names, but you would never know it. Nobody ever refers to each other by that name. So you have to do more than just give your characters names to make them characters. So from one scene to the next, I never got the impression anybody was a character. I just got the impression they were coming out and singing the song.
So Triple Love is playing at Stage 42. It's open-ended, and they're selling tickets through June. Do we think that it's going to find an audience?
We don't.
No, though I am not as 100% certain of that as I would have been before I met this lady at the party, who did bring up the thing that I hear a lot from all of these shows, like Smokey Joe's Cafe, and that is, you know, it's good to hear the old songs again.
Mm-hmm.
Jersey Boys, too. Jersey Boys, of course, has a very good book, a solid book, and I know that's one of the reasons why it's been here now and forever, but the thing is that all things considered, the average person who hasn't heard these songs, the average baby boomer who hasn't heard these songs in a while, will get some sort of happiness out of that. So so while I don't think they'll be here through June, they may be here a few days more than I suspect.
One more plus and minus. There I had forgotten or didn't even realize there's an actual orchestra pit in the theater, an open orchestra pit in this case, which is fantastic. And I thought the arrangements and the orchestrations were really excellent. But on the minus side, I thought everything was a little too loud. So so there's that plus and minus.
All right. Before we wrap up, Michael got a chance to see production of OK at Musicals Tonight, and while it is closing today, October 25th, we wanted to mention it for an outstanding performance. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, I full disclosure, as I've mentioned before, I take the production photos for the company Musicals Tonight, so take that for what it's worth. But I have to say, this is one of their best shows ever. They have a new director, choreographer for this show, Casey Colgan. They actually have five new directors for the five shows they're doing this coming season, one of whom is Evan Pappas. Did you know that, Peter?
No, no, I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they've gotten new blood in. They had initially announced that this was going to be their last season, but I think that they have the whole company feels reinvigorated, and it's so they have announced that it's not going to be their last season, their 18th season, by the way. So hopefully they'll at least make it to 20, if not beyond. But I did want to mention the show because for a few things, this is the original OK, not the awful rewrite. Nice work if you can get it, that we saw on Broadway a few years ago. And the cast was really very strong about the across the board. But I really do want to mention this Elizabeth Broadhurst, who I thought was stellar as Kay. She just had so much charisma, a lovely soprano. Her two separate British accents, upper class and lower, sounded great to me. And she looked beautiful and just she really sparkled on stage. And I do think that we are going to hear much more from her. So far, she has played Grace in Annie at Madison Square Garden with Kathy Lee Gifford and John Shuck. And she has toured as Mrs. Banks and Mary Understudy in Mary Poppins. And she did a European tour of Hair, 1776 at the Guthrie as Martha Jefferson. I think you're going to hear her name again. So definitely remember that, Elizabeth Broadhurst.
Let's hear it at the Broadhurst.
I was just thinking that, Peter. All right, so that kind of wraps it up for this week. Before we get to trivia, I want to remind people that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that we each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me, and for Matt can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well on our show page, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So the answer to the trivia from last week, Michael, why don't you take that?
Yes, the question was, there is a musical in which at one point the leading lady calls herself by another name. She tells the leading man that her name is something other than it actually is, and she picks another name. There's another musical at which at one point the leading man calls the leading lady by a name other than her own. And in both of those cases, the name is the same. So the question was, what is the name? Who are the characters? What are the shows? And the name is Melisande, because in Bells Are Ringing, Ella Peterson finally meets Geoffrey Moss, but he doesn't realize that she's the woman who's been taking his answering service messages, and she doesn't want him to know that. So at one point he asks her name, and she says, Melisande Scott. And then in 110 in the Shade, when Lizzie and Starbuck finally start to get together late in the show, he says something to the effect of, well, Lizzie is not a, you know, it's a common name. It's not, it doesn't suit you. Your name should be something like Melisande. And then he sings a whole really beautiful song, a really fantastic number called Melisande, about weaving this fantastic tale of the Golden Fleece, and he puts together Hamlet and the story of Jason and the Argonauts, and weaves this wonderful, really funny, beautiful tale about this Melisande and the man who's striving for her. So this we got three correct answers to the question. The first from Carol Lockhart, the second from John Baccarella, and the third from Steve Bell. And one interesting thing is John Baccarella wrote, and I had to laugh because I knew exactly what he meant. He said he had to double check it because he wasn't sure if Ella Peterson said her name was Millicent. And it's funny because I first knew Bells Are Ringing from the original cast recording before I had seen it, before I did the show, before I saw the movie. And it does sound to me like she says, like she sings, Judy Holliday sings, he's in love with Millicent Scott. But it wasn't until I saw the movie and then read the script of the show when we did it in high school that I found out that, in fact, it's Melisande. So I'm glad to know I wasn't the only one who thought she said Millicent.
All right, Peter, give us the new trivia question.
Sure. Connie McKenzie has been a character in what world-famous musical? That's it.
Connie McKenzie
has been a character in what world-famous musical?
I'm sorry, is the first name Connie?
Yeah.
C-O-N-N-I-E.
That's right.
All right, if you know that answer, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you have come upon the right answer. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Matt Tamanini, and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've got the greatest name for you. The greatest name. Just listen.
Melisande. I don't like it.
Well, that's because you don't know anything about her. But when I tell you who she was... Oh, lady, when I tell you who she was...
Who?
Why, she was the most beautiful... She was the beautiful wife of King Hamlet. Ever hear of him?
Go on, Starbuck. Go on.
Now, once upon a time, so they tell us, somewhere beneath the mountains of Mexico, there dwelt a royal fella, King Hamlet, who had a turtle dove and he loved her so. Her name was Melisande, and I tell you, that lady was as pretty as she could be. But Melisande was bothered, so Hamlet starts to plead. Tell me what you need. And Melisande whispers, I've got me a dream. I've always wanted a golden fleece, and I think I will...